It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, the right advice at the right time with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And Cecil is solo in the studio this morning. Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
We're doing well. If people would like to call in, again, we have the 800 number and our local numbers, too, ready for you to call in. And, Mandy, what are those local numbers?
That's 247-7282 and 353-4674.
So what are we talking about today, Cecil?
Well, Ben, you recall that last week Andrew Foster was here with me and we discussed the various tax filings that are required for in the estate capacity,
right,
in the capacity as executor of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the most obvious one is, of course, the filing of the final income tax return.
Mm-hmm.
We are all very, very busy right now, on or before the April 15th deadline that is quickly approaching, filing our individual tax returns. And, of course, when we lose a loved one, the executor is going to need to take the responsibility to file that final return.
Right.
And mark that Social Security number, if you will, with the Internal Revenue Service as a decedent, so that they will not in the future be expecting an income tax return, and so that they also can monitor their the tax filings and begin the process of closing out that taxpayer's identification.
And that, well, that means, Cecil, then, that an executor's duty, someone passes away this year, their executor's duty continues into next year, right? Because they still have to file a tax return next year.
Oh, yes. The duty of the executor continues until all of these tax filings that we're going to talk about today are filed. And, of course, sometimes, you know, as we discussed last week, you have a year on, a leg on in a year. Some a decedent will die in February or March. Well, clearly, you might even be in the process of filing last year's return at that time.
Right.
But you're going to need to file the first of the following year, the final return.
Okay. We have a phone call, and Marshall is online with a question for us. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning there, Ben. I need a little information there.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a covenants. Here's how it is. It's a covenants on this plat, and it don't have a committee. And if you put a new home in or whatever, are they liable for suit for trash? I mean, to junk cars and all that kind of story.
If that's in the covenant, right? That's
yeah.
What you're asking.
Okay, in the covenants, it says all buildings and grounds shall be kept in a neat and sanitary condition.
Uh-huh. Well, Marshall, that right there is halfway around the ball field in terms of being able to enforce something. Absolutely. If someone has taken title to those lots or those properties within that subdivision, subject to that language that you just enumerated to me, just recited to me, then they, of course, are going to be required to keep their property in, you know, respectable condition. Now, I might add, however, that even if there were no such covenant or requirement in writing, the law in general, Ben, it's a bit more, you know, difficult to enforce, but there is general public policy law that requires that property not be or become a nuisance or a danger, wrecked cars, junk,
right,
equipment, things of this
unsanitary
nature. Unsanitary. There are usually those kinds of things violate maybe some county or local ordinance.
Right. But in his case, without a homeowners association, Marshall, I would imagine your next question is, how do you enforce that?
Well, he's able to enforce it as an individual, a homeowner, because he has standing. He's a member of that subdivision. He's a member of that organization, if you will, of property owners. And so certainly the association has the right to enforce it, but they're not maybe existing.
Yeah.
They're not as organized as they should be.
Here's another question. Okay. You put a new home in, and here comes these people that's got these rentals on each side of you. Okay, they start trashing the place up, junk cars and all that. Now, are they liable for suit for lowering the price of my property?
Well, that would fall into what a lawyer might talk about in terms of speculative damages, or damages that are sometimes difficult to establish. Marshall, I mean, that's kind of a gray area. I mean, it would depend if it is really truly, diminution in your value, if it can absolutely be, proven.
But
then
wouldn't he be more likely to try to pursue, basically kind of like contract law, like a specific performance, just trying to get it cleaned up?
Yes, that's exactly what he would, and also restraining orders to cease it from continuing to decline further.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those options would be available for him.
Yeah.
That's what we call the remedy.
Yeah.
Remedies.
Right.
We take a class in law school known just as remedies. And there are several remedies here. We want to enjoin the people from future trashing of the property. We want to require that they clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, make there be some proactive duty that they clean it up. And lastly, have we been damaged by money damages?
Mm-hmm.
And these would
right.
be the issues that a court would need to determine.
Sounds like, Marshall, you can get some advice on that.
That's right. And this county needs cleaned up. I've never seen nothing like it.
All right.
Reason I'm saying that, I go to garage sales. You people don't see what I see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is unreal. They need to pass some laws here on this stuff.
All right. Thank you, Marshall. Okay. There you go. And again, though, that's a good question about property.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Ben, back to the context of estates and settling estates and the duties of the executor to file certain tax returns. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, I think we've said enough now about the filing of the final income tax return. There is another tax return that the executor has to be very aware of, and it's known as the fiduciary tax return or the income tax return for the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And let me explain that for a minute. When we lose a loved one, on a date of death, if you will, their assets begin to continue,
mm-hmm.
1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, to draw income if they're postured in that case.
Right.
In such an investment.
Bless you.
I mean, for instance, if we are in certain stocks
mm-hmm.
or CDs or any kind of investment, posture. Those assets are not just going to stop drawing the
mm-hmm.
interest that they
right.
that they accumulate.
Right.
And so the law is that if during the course of a calendar year of
mm-hmm.
the estate, the gross income of the estate is more than $600,
mm-hmm.
then that estate is going to be required to file an income tax return or a fiduciary tax return. This is a Form 1041 that is then filed. And, $600 of income, Ben, is not a whole lot.
That's like the 1099 level, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not a whole lot.
Yeah.
And so many times an executor is required to set forward this fiduciary income tax return. Again, the income being reported at the estate level.
Right.
Because it hasn't yet been distributed to the beneficiaries,
mm-hmm.
so the income is not really trapped at their level or reported at their level, nor can it be still the income of the decedent on his 1040 or her 1040 because they're no longer living, they're
right.
no longer with us. So this is income that is kind of in transition between the
mm-hmm.
decedent and, of course, ultimately the beneficiaries. This is an important factor that we recognize early on in a file,
mm-hmm.
and we will sometimes work in smaller estates to move the assets pretty quickly before they can trigger this $600 of income. In larger estates, there's really no way to avoid that. you're going to trigger that, and that tax return is going to be necessary.
All right. Again, if you have questions about your taxes or about, as Marshall did, about other things in your civil legal life, you can give us a call right now, and Mandy will take that call.
You can call me at 800-818-2255 or one of our local numbers, 247-7282 or 353-4674.
And we'll have more to come on Let's Talk Legal, brought to you by Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law, in just a moment. Hey, welcome back. Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. And every Tuesday morning, Let's Talk Legal, brought to you by Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. And we're talking about estate taxes.
Well, we are. And we're talking about one of the other kinds of, one of the many duties that fall on the shoulders of our executors. And of course, when I say the word executor, that is also, synonymous with, you know, administrator. Administrator has the same duties as executor.
Right.
The only difference between an administrator and an executor is an administrator is the person that is appointed by law, by the clerk of court, to handle the estate, since there was no will.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a will, then we have a named executor, and therefore they would qualify. But many people, unfortunately, die without a will, and then usually the next of kin, in mm-hmm. some semblance of priority, come forward and qualify as the executor, but yet they are called an administrator.
Right, right.
Their duties are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the duties, one of the categories of duties that they're going to have to be attentive to is the tax filings. And, of course, there is this this one that is kind of mysterious to most of our clients in terms of, you know, the income of the estate. Sometimes estates accrue income in other ways. There could be potential, royalties mm-hmm. or rentals or any other kind of, interest payments.
Right.
All of those would be considered income. And they just don't stop, of course, because we lost our loved one or because there is a decedent. You know, these obligations of the obligor, if you will, the mm-hmm. person who was making the payments, still continue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We many times get the question, you know, that the obligor will call the office and
right.
say something to the effect of, well, I understand that Mr. Jones died. Who do I make the check payable to now?
Yes.
I certainly am not going to go into default mm-hmm. just because of the fact that Mr. Jones is no longer here. Do I make the check payable to his wife? Do I make it payable to the estate?
Mm-hmm.
How do you direct that I handle this? Okay.
Yeah.
So, absolutely, these issues are out there. There still continues to be an accrual, if you will,
mm-hmm.
or generation of income at the estate level. And if it exceeds $600 during the calendar year,
mm-hmm.
then this return is going to be necessary.
And there you go. I mean, somebody who passes away owns a lot of rental property, and that's going to happen the next month.
Correct.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, our number's here. If you would like to call and ask a question, Mandy will take that call from you.
800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674.
And again, your questions about estates or taxes or other civil questions, we'll handle those too. What else do you have for us on that score?
Well, last but not least, Ben, and I'm glad we've got enough time to mention it today, is, of course, the estate tax return.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very different than the 1040, which is the final tax return
mm-hmm.
of the decedent, or the fiduciary, which is the income.
Mm-hmm.
The estate tax return truly is a look at, by the taxing authority at the value of
mm-hmm.
the assets in the estate.
Right, right.
A tax, if you will, on the assets of the estate. Not the income,
mm-hmm.
just do the assets, do they total the amount of net worth that is applicable that then generates this estate tax.
So it's the snapshot at death?
It is a snapshot on the date of death of the assets of the estate. And the assets of the estate is very broad. In other words, any kind of incident of ownership in an asset. So, for instance, many people think that life insurance or an annuity or assets that pass outside the probate estate are not taxable. And that, unfortunately, that's a faulty thought, okay? Life insurance proceeds, annuities, IRAs, 401ks, things that we have incidents of ownership in are, in fact, included in the snapshot. Now, if the life insurance is owned by the by someone else, like, say, the adult child, or spouses own life insurance on each other, then again, the incident of ownership is going to follow the owner. The incident of ownership is going to follow who owns the policy.
Not who is to receive
Not who is insured.
Right.
The insured person, the person who has to die,
right?
Nor the person who would be the beneficiary. It's the question is who has control over that policy,
right?
And that is the person then that has the incident of ownership.
Okay, I would take a short break. We'll come back with more here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, here on the Talk Station. And you're welcome to call us and call in with your question too at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Hey, welcome back here. We're talking about issues surrounding estates and estate taxes, and Cecil Harvell with us from Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, who bring you Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning.
Now, the estate tax law, Ben, as most of our listeners know, has just been, it is so extremely complicated, and it continues to really kind of mystify most folks.
And it's volatile because it's a political football.
Right, it does. It's just changing. For years and years and years, our listeners will recall that estate tax was triggered after estates that were more than $600,000, and then it went up to $1 million. Now, of course, there is even a sponge effect, if you will, between spouses so that they are able to elect the unused unified credit amount of the first to die. So it is a complicated area. And if you have an estate that, you know, is in the, in, you know, it does have to be an estate that has assets that are significant.
Right.
Okay. You know, that are pushing, you know, the $3-4 million level. Then you're going to want to talk to, your accountant, your lawyer, your estate lawyer about these issues and whether or not a filing would be necessary for some reason, of course, because it's going to turn greatly on, is there a surviving spouse, or is this the second to die?
Right.
And again, there's going to be a very concrete check into the actual value that we're talking about, the snapshot, the fair market value of the estate assets on the date of death. But if a return is required, then absolutely it's going to be the duty of the executor to see that it is filed. It's filed within 9 months of the date of death, unless for some reason it's then extended.
Okay. So it is a, again, it's part of that fiduciary responsibility of an executor.
Right.
And
another thing that I think I'd like to say about about estate tax is that estate tax, Ben, and gift tax are related. They have been integrated, if you will. And this makes perfect sense because if they were not integrated, then a lot of folks would give away all of their assets within the last year of their death. Within a year of their death, they would just simply give away their assets.
Right, right.
So as to avoid the estate tax. Okay? Makes perfect sense.
Sure, yeah.
So as a result of that, the two taxes are integrated and they are coordinated. And the law is that, you know, you may give away during your life up to the same amount that you can be non-taxed if you were to die.
In other words, up to the unified tax credit amount.
Correct.
Okay.
And so you have this unified tax credit amount, You may either use it at your death,
mm-hmm.
or you may use it during your lifetime. And you can also, which is usually the case, many times the case, combine the two.
Mm-hmm.
Use a certain amount of it while you were living,
right,
and the rest of it when you die,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, triggers the filing of a gift tax return while we're living to show the federal government that even though we are still living, we have used $500,000 mm-hmm. or whatever the amount might be of our unified credit, but we used it while we were living.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, when we die, that $500,000 is no longer available.
Right, right. Understand.
Right. So gift tax returns are interesting. They are, therefore, very informational mm-hmm. in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that there's usually tax due, because there usually isn't tax due because mm-hmm. of, you know, folks aren't giving beyond the unified credit amount. They might give up to it. There's no tax due, but it's sharing with the taxing authority the
extent of the
information.
Yeah, right.
The extent of the gift during
now,
life.
Does that include charitable gifts?
Well, no. Charitable gifts are deductible mm-hmm. and are deductions on the estate tax return. They also are deductions on the gift tax return.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give an unlimited amount of money to a recognized and legitimate charity.
Okay. Again, if you want to find out more about all of this information, there's a lot to absorb there, too. You want to consult the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. The right advice at the right time. Give them a call at 252-726-9050. Of course, online at harvellandcollins.com and 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City.